And I've had the opportunity to be with Paul last night and this morning, and he delivered two very different, very good messages. Paul's been speaking on creation, evolution, and Genesis for more than 30 years. And he taught science for 18 years in England. He's worked with AIG in the UK and Creation Today in Florida. He's now full-time speaker and director of Mount St. Helens Creation Center. And Paul has authored more than 10 books, many DVDs, and a countless number of articles. And Paul has agreed to take questions after his message tonight. And just as a warning to you guys, if there is a little accent that you hear when he starts speaking, he'll quickly remind us that he's not the one with the accent. So let's welcome Paul Taylor.
Well, good evening to you. Thank you very much indeed for inviting me here. It's a pleasure to be here with you again. Yes, this isn't an accent. The language is called English for a reason. You know, when my eldest son was in the United States, he was leading a Bible camp in Oklahoma, and one of the teenagers on the course said to him, well, what language do they speak in England then? So he said, well, English. She said, that's amazing. She said, say something to me in English. So there we go. She was blonde, I have to add. Well, we're going to be talking about James Usher tonight the history of biblical chronology. And by the way, just seeing all the various notices there, maybe I could just mention a couple of dates for your diary of my own, if that's okay. October 29th, the Sunday before, it's the last Sunday of the month, we're doing a celebration in place of October 31st, okay? You know what happens on October 31st, don't you? Absolutely right, and that's what we're celebrating in our Creation Center. We've got an event called Reformation 500, so I know you'll have lots of interesting things here going on at this church, but if there's anyone who lives further south who wants to drive down to Castle Rock, we'll be doing an event called Reformation 500, where I'll be taking some questions, we'll be having a discussion, and we will actually see an old BBC film, so taking a risk there, an old BBC film called Martin Luther Heretic, but it's actually surprisingly good for the BBC. You all heard of the BBC, haven't you? You know, the Babylon Broadcasting Corporation. So that's October 29th. On November the 4th, of course, Pat Newey's got the event at his centre. You live closer to him, so you better go there. But if there's anyone who's travelled from further south and wants to come to our place, the Mount St. Helens Creation Centre in Castle Rock, we will be having an event that day as well because it is International Creation Day. There is a conference going on in Santee, California. But you may not want to drive quite that far south, so we will be live streaming that in our centre. With all the speakers there featuring John Baumgartner and Eric Hovind and Russ Miller. And actually mentioning Eric Hovind, Eric Hovind and Ralph Streen from Creation Today have spent a lot of time working on a marvelous film which is going to be released on November the 13th, and it will be out in all the movie theatres. November the 13th. It's called Genesis, Paradise Lost. It is the first ever, the world's first ever 3D creation film. So your local movie theatre, it'll be on in two screens. It'll be on in the 3D screen and it'll be on a normal 2D one for those of you who hate having those glasses on. So go to genesismovie.com and book that. And then we've got a mini conference at the Mount St. Helens Creation Center on December the 1st and December the 2nd. Jay Seagate is coming from Wisconsin. He'll be our main speaker, and I'll be doing a couple of talks as well. So that's December 1st and 2nd, Friday and Saturday. All those details are on our website if you want to find out anything more about those. So as I said, we're going to talk about James Usher. But before we do that, if I can just indulge myself for a little bit longer, if you don't mind, I'll tell you a little bit about our centre. There's my wife and myself with the volcano in the background. That day, it was actually quite clear for once, but quite often the volcano was covered in cloud. But people come to our centre, we have family days, we have activities, we'll do presentations, and we will take people on excursions up the valley. There is our centre. We've removed the old city council sign from it now, and we're now just raising a little bit more money to be able to get it painted and renovated. We haven't had the opportunity to paint it and renovate it because we have had an exceptionally busy summer. We only got hold of the building in May, and the tourist season started straight away. And I've been taking people to the mountain, doing 3 or 4 excursions per week since May until the beginning of October, when it began to slow down. Though I am still doing some excursions. I've got one on Monday. So we are raising money for that. I'll let you know a little bit more about that in a moment. But some of the things that we've got, we've now got tourist signs on the interstate so that you can find out where we are. So if you go to exit 49 on I-5, you will see the signs pointing the way to our new centre in the middle of downtown Castle Rock. And as I said, we like to take people on excursions. So here's a little bit of an overview of the sort of excursions that we take people on. Some of those clips then are from our forthcoming movie that we've got, that we produced at our centre in conjunction with our sister ministry, Creation Moments, and that should be available on DVD and video download next month, in the middle of November, in time for the Christmas market. Okay, and in order to sort of finance the various excursions we're doing, in particular to be able to get our building renovated, we are making an appeal. We have been appealing for funds during the year, and I've got a little video clip that the producers of that film were able to make for me. In this video clip, I'll mention that we are trying to raise $40,000. Well, praise God, we have raised $23,000 of that already. So we are trying to raise another $17,000 before the end of this year to complete the renovation of our building, make a really good center that we can be proud of. So if any of you feel able to participate in that and contribute to that, then have a look at our website or come and see me, and I'll explain to you how we can help with that. So here we go. Try it. No, there we go. Okay, so we would value your prayers and your support in that, so that we've had a lot of visitors this summer, visitors from all over the world, families from Australia, New Zealand, a strange little place called England, as well as from every corner of the United States. Okay, well, we're going to be talking about James Usher. There used to be a time when in these sort of talks we would tell you all to turn your cell phones off, but we don't do that anymore. So if any of you want to tweet about what I'm saying, then please feel free to do so. There are two suggested hashtags for you, #MSHCC for Mount St. Helens Creation Center, or you can put #Usher. You'll notice his name spelt with a double S. Okay, so those are two hashtags you could use if you're trying to say anything about what we're going to say tonight on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. Okay. By the way, if you're over 40 and you haven't got a clue what I've just been saying, okay, then just ask a young person sat with you. Okay, well, Archbishop Usher is famous for dating the age of the earth. And here's another famous piece of dating. This particular set of rocks called Salisbury Crags in Edinburgh in Scotland are very, very famous and very influential. And many of you may not know exactly why they are. Well, the reason why they are is because these rocks were studied by a man called James Hutton, who evolutionists would refer to as the father of modern geology. James Hutton is the man who invented millions of years. He looked at these rocks and some other rocks to the east of Edinburgh at a place called Sicker Point. And in both those cases, he said that these formations must have taken millions and millions of years to form. He was the man who invented, therefore, in about 1760, the concept of millions of years. And it was not due to radiometric dating, because radiometric dating did not exist at that time. The reason why he came up with millions of years were made pretty clear to me when I took this photograph. I was on one of these open-top tour buses going around Edinburgh. And the driver stopped at this point. It's an interesting point in the road to stop, because downtown Edinburgh is very close to the hills. So, in fact, on the left-hand side of the bus, you could see Britain's ugliest building, which is the new Scottish Parliament. Straight ahead of us, you could see Holyrood Palace, a much nicer building, where the Queen stays when she's in Edinburgh. And to the right, you could see Salisbury Crags. And the guide said, here are Salisbury Crags. It was by studying these rocks in 1760 that the geologist James Hutton proved that the Bible was wrong. That's what he said. That's what was James Hutton was interested in, because he didn't like the timescale of Genesis. By the way, you see that line there between the upper layers of rocks and the lower rocks. That's called an unconformity. It is smooth. And you don't get smooth erosion if the erosion takes a long time. The fact that you've got smooth erosion there suggests that the erosion must have happened very quick. So this did not take millions of years at all. It's, we would suggest that these rocks were laid down during the flood. But as I said, James Hutton, James Usher, had a date for the earth. And so many people wonder what the creationist response should be to the people who tell us that the earth is millions of years old. And there are various responses that creationists have had to this. Some creationists have simply said, well, we should refuse to accept evolution, and instead we should look at other dating systems. So we should start with looking at the science behind other dating systems that will give us a shorter age for the earth, maybe an age of 10,000 years or less. And I've heard people referred to as young earth creationists when they believe that the earth is 10,000 years or younger. Actually, you may be interested to know that in England, there is one creationist group which describes itself as a young earth creationist group that believes the earth is 30,000 years old. But many young earth creationists would define themselves as being those who believe the earth to be 10,000 years old or younger. Once they've made that definition from their scientific experiments, they'll look at scripture and they'll say, well, that seems to confirm what we've just said with our science. So we'll start with the science and we'll move to scripture. I'm going to argue that that's the wrong way round. That is not the way round we should work. Instead, I would suggest that we do what James Usher did, which is start from a biblical presupposition. We start by saying we believe the Bible to be true because it's God's word. And when we believe the Bible to be true, we do not get an age of 10,000 years. We get an age of around about 6,000 years. So those people who say that the earth is 10,000 years or younger are not starting from the Bible. And so they refer to themselves as young earth creationists. My position would be that the earth is about 6,000 years old, a little bit older than that, because we start from scripture to get that. And I don't actually like to refer to myself as a young earth creationist, because I don't believe that the earth is young. Let that sink in for a moment. I don't believe the earth is young. I believe the earth is very, very old. Let that sink in before someone takes me out ready to stone me as a heretic. I believe the earth is so old that it's about 6,000 years old. That is old. That is old. I get that age from the Bible. If you say you're a young earth creationist, young earth compared to what? It's only young if you compare the age of the earth to an evolutionary age. And why should I want to define myself simply by my opposition to what the evolutionists say? I'm not going to do that. The earth is not young. The idea of millions of years is simply a nonsense. A deep time aspect of things is simply a nonsense. It's something that simply is too incredible, that does not work in any sphere. The earth is very old. 6,000 years by any human stretch of the imagination is very old. Has anyone ever been to Stonehenge in England? Probably round about 4,000 years old, probably built by the first people to have left the Tower of Babel and managed to get to the British Isles. Could you imagine standing at the scene of Stonehenge and saying, well, that's a young object, isn't it? There's a young artifact because it's only 4,000 years old. No, you don't. You say it's ancient. Even the British government say it's ancient. They've got a sign outside it saying ancient monument. It's ancient. The earth is ancient. 6,000 years old is ancient. I'm not, do you get the message? I may be laboring this, but it's important. I define my ages relative to what the Bible says, not relative to what evolutionists say. We need to interpret our dating systems according to the Bible, not interpret the Bible according to our dating systems. We don't simply pick and choose dating systems until we find one that fits. We start from the Word of God. and see where the consequences are for that. Now, when Archbishop Usher was looking at the Old Testament, he realized that names in the Old Testament have meanings. For example, the name Cain means acquired. So I find it very interesting that we read in Genesis chapter 4, verse 1, about the birth of Cain. In Genesis chapter 4, verse 1, this is what we read. We read, Adam knew Eve, his wife. She conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. Acquired or gotten, that means Cain. So you need to understand what she said. She's conceived and bore Cain, that means gotten, and says, I have gotten a man. Do you see? Now, there's a bit more to it even than that, because actually, the Hebrew doesn't say, with the help of the Lord. That's an interpretation that's been added in most of our translations. Literally, the Hebrew simply says, I have gotten a man, the Lord. Because I believe that Eve had actually believed what God said in Genesis 3 when he was promising the Messiah to come to crush the head of the serpent. So she thought that maybe her firstborn son, being the seed of the woman, would be the Messiah. Now, I know a lot of us have great ambitions for our children. I think Eve's ambition for her first son was a little bit overblown, especially when we learn what happened. But at least we can say that Eve almost certainly had saving faith. After her sin, she had come to believe, I would suggest, she'd come to believe in the Messiah. And we get all that by knowing about the name Cain. The name Abel means something. It actually means vapor. And in fact, that word is often used to refer to something being meaningless, or in the old King James way of saying it, vanity of vanities. In fact, the word in the book of Ecclesiastes, where it constantly says vanity of vanities, meaningless, meaningless, that is the word Abel. So the words actually mean something. So when we come to 1 Chronicles chapter 1, we get the most odd beginning to a book in the Bible that you could possibly imagine. 1 Chronicles chapter 1 simply begins by saying, Adam, Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, Noah, Shem, Ham, Japheth, and so on. It's got a list of names over and over again. A long list of names. That's what it's about. What on earth could that mean? How on earth can we understand what the first book of Chronicles is saying? Now, some people have suggested, I think rightly, that the difference between Chronicles and the books of Kings is that the books of Kings are straight history, whereas Chronicles is a sermon being preached on the text of the history that's happened. In which case, we can perhaps understand why we would begin with those names by looking at the meanings of the names. Because Adam means man. Seth means appointed. Enosh means mortal. Kenan means sorrow. Mahalalel means the God who is praised. It's interesting that round about that time, that's approximately the time that people would have started calling on the name of the Lord, as we read in Genesis chapter 4. So there was worship of God. That's why we've got a one in the line there from Adam that's called the God who is to be praised. Jared means he shall come down. That's an acknowledgement of our mortality, because we're lower than God. Enoch means the teacher or the prophet. Methuselah means his death shall bring it about. And that's a prophetic name. Enoch, Methuselah's father, was a prophet. We've got words of prophecy by Enoch in the book of Jude, which is referring to the judgment of God. Well, he's even named his son, I believe, in order to emphasize this prophecy of the coming judgment, because the name Methuselah means his death shall bring it about. His death shall bring what about? Well, we'll see in a moment. Lamech means weary. It's another warning of mortality. And in fact, if there are no gaps in the genealogies there, then actually Lamech died before Methuselah did. In fact, died before his father did. And finally, Noah, that's as far as I'll go for now, that Noah means rest or peace. And Noah, of course, is very much a type of Christ in the Bible. In John's Gospel, John chapter 14, verse 27, we read, "My peace I give to you, peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. Not as the world gives, do I give to you. Let not your hearts be troubled, neither let them be afraid." Jesus is talking about the peace he brings, and Noah's name means rest or peace. Well, if we put all those meanings together, you get a list of these patriarchs, not only in 1 Chronicles, but also, of course, in Genesis chapter 5, where you also get the ages of these people, and I'll refer to that in a moment. But I've said that these are the meanings of the names. Well, if we put all that together, it means that the first three verses of 1 Chronicles actually reads like this: "Man is appointed mortal sorrow, but the God who is to be praised shall come down, teaching that his death shall bring the weary rest." That's what we read in those first few names in 1 Chronicles, because the names mean something. And in those first 10 patriarchs, we have a statement of the gospel of Jesus Christ leading up to the man who is called peace. And Jesus says, "My peace I leave with you." Isn't that beautiful? You see what God was doing. And this is why Genesis and other references to creation in the Bible are so important. This is not an optional extra. It's not an optional extra to say, well, it doesn't matter what you believe about Genesis. We can believe what we like about Genesis. Let's just preach Jesus. People have said that to me many times. Don't go into these controversies. Don't get people upset. Just preach Jesus. Can you see that when I go through these names, I am preaching Jesus? That is what we are doing. That's what is so important. The names further on mean something too. Nimrod is an important name. We read in Genesis, "Like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord, a mighty warrior against the Lord." Really, when it says he's a mighty hunter before the Lord, it really means somebody who is against the Lord. In other words, Nimrod is a man who shakes his fist in the face of God. A man who doesn't acknowledge God as Lord. Other names that mean something are names like Peleg, and his generation must have been approximately around about the time of Babel, because we read in Peleg that was the days when the earth was divided. And it can't refer to geological division, because that would have happened at the time of the flood, whereas this is after the flood. So it's referring to the division of the peoples of the world. Well, these are the things that James Usher studied. And in consequence, by studying these and by studying the numbers that you get in chapters like Genesis chapter 5 and Genesis chapter 11, he calculated the exact time that he believed creation had happened. So he calculated that the date of creation was 6 p.m. on October the 23rd, 4004 B.C., Actually, I've got that wrong. He actually said it was the evening before. I've got it right on the slide. What I've just read to you is wrong. He calculated 6 p.m. the evening before October the 23rd, 4004 B.C. I'll come back to why he said 6 p.m. the evening before October the 23rd shortly, the reason for that. But you see, Archbishop Usher has been made fun of for saying things like that. People have criticized Archbishop Usher for saying things like this. So we need to understand a little bit about the context of Archbishop Usher. You see, I've even seen cartoons produced by one so-called Christian ministry that actually showed Archbishop James Usher, because he was the Archbishop of Armagh in Ireland at that time. It shown him looking like some sort of a dunce, counting numbers on his fingers and on his toes as well. He'd taken his socks off and he's counting his toes. A Christian ministry ridiculing and making fun of Archbishop Usher, because the idea is that he was too simple to be able to get the whole idea of millions of years. If he'd been a lot cleverer, he would have been able to work out the theory of evolution. Well, that's not the case. And in order to prove that, I'm going to need to give you a short potted biography of Archbishop Usher. So let's have a little look at his life. Archbishop Usher was born into a very different world than we are in today. Queen Elizabeth I became queen in 1558. At the time, There had been a considerable amount of things going on before this. It was a very turbulent period of history. The previous ruler of England had been Queen Mary Tudor, and that was the most dreadful period of English history. That is the period of English history where Christians were burned alive for being Christians. People like Bishop Latimer, people like Archbishop Cranmer, burned alive for believing in the salvation that is taught in the Bible. So when Queen Elizabeth came to the throne in 1558, there was very much a hope among Christians that things would turn back, that the Reformation in England would be restarted, having been stalled before, that it would now be restarted. But in the year 1558, her position, when she came to the throne, her position was not very stable at all. It was an extremely unstable situation in England. And that brings us then to Archbishop Usher. As I said, Elizabeth I was made queen in 1558. The 39 Articles of the Church of England were completed in 1563. It's worth reading the 39 Articles of the Church of England. They actually predate the Book of Common Prayer by nearly 100 years, the Book of Common Prayer being published in 1662. But the original 39 Articles, which are a great statement of biblical belief, very much based on the teachings of both Luther and Calvin, were completed in 1563. John Calvin, of course, died in 1564, and that's the same year that William Shakespeare was born. So you can see the pattern here that we've got, the period of time that we're talking about. Elizabeth I was excommunicated because of her stand for Protestantism. She was excommunicated by Pope Pius V in 1570, and then James Usher was born on January the 4th, 1581. So that is the that's the world into which James Usher came. The Spanish Armada was in 1588. A lot of people don't realize the significance of the Spanish Armada. It was not just a little local war between England and Spain. The Spanish Navy was at that time the superpower of the world. England has a history of having been a naval power, but that hadn't really got going at that time. Spain was the country that had the big navy, and they were a Catholic country, and the Pope had actually asked the King of Spain personally to go and conquer England, to bring England back into the Roman Catholic fold. That is what had happened. That's the background to that. So the fact that England won that battle against the Spanish Armada in 1588 is actually a miraculous example of salvation. Because humanly speaking, it should not have happened. The Spanish Navy was far superior. So James Usher, as I said, famous for dating creation. Why did he come up with this date? Here are some of the cartoons that are produced by one Christian ministry called Reasons to Believe, led by a gentleman called Dr. Hugh Ross. He doesn't think it matters if the days of creation were real days, and he doesn't believe that the days of creation were real days, whereas Archbishop Usher did. Well, let's see whether Archbishop Usher really was the simpleton that we consider. Archbishop Usher was born in Dublin on the island of Ireland. At the time, Ireland was part of... it was not part of England. It was actually a separate kingdom, but it was ruled by the same monarch. Elizabeth I was also Queen of Ireland, as well as being Queen of England. Later on, Scotland became part of the same system too. And the three countries were not actually joined at that stage. It was quite a lot later that they were joined. When James I of Scotland became King of England, he also became King of Ireland as well. He was King of all three countries, but they were still all three independent countries. Okay. Now, Usher was born at 57 High Street, Dublin. There's a picture of 57 High Street, Dublin, but that's clearly not the house in which James Usher was born. I wonder if you know how you can tell that, by the way. Here's a little bit of a bunny trail. That's a Georgian building. It was built in the time of King George III. How do I know that? I know that because of the shape of the windows, because on Georgian buildings you always have at least three stories, at least three floors, and the windows get successively smaller as you go up the building. Did you know that? So a lot of Georgian buildings in Dublin, there's actually more Georgian buildings in Dublin than there are left in London, because a lot of them were destroyed during the Second World War in London. So actually there are many films that you think are set in London that are really filmed in Dublin. It's very often the case, because the buildings look like London buildings. So Usher was born in a building on that site, where you can see on the map there where that would have been. Now, his uncle, Henry Usher, had also been the Archbishop of Armagh and therefore the Primate of all Ireland. The Usher family were very important in Dublin. Look at the square on the map that I've just produced there, and if I expand that square, you'll see that there is a street called Usher Street. Interestingly enough, spelt with only one S, because they hadn't quite finalised spelling at that time. But there's Usher Street and there's Usher Quay, so you can see that the Usher family were important. In fact, James Usher's father... James Usher's mother was called Margaret Stanihurst, and her father, therefore James Usher's grandfather, James Stanihurst, had been the Speaker of the Irish House of Commons for three successive terms. Okay, so that's a map of Dublin then. Here is Christ Church Cathedral in Dublin, very close to where Usher's house is. Usher's house, where he was born, is labelled as letter A. Then you've got St. Patrick's Cathedral there. It's interesting that in Ireland, which is a Roman Catholic country, there are no Catholic cathedrals in the capital city, Dublin. Both those cathedrals are actually Anglican cathedrals, interestingly enough. There's Dublin Castle. And you might think, well, that's an odd place for a castle to be. There's not a lot of defence there. For a start, in front of the castle there, you've got this large green space. But in Usher's time, it wasn't a green space. It was actually a river. That river has been put into a tunnel underground now, and the city of Dublin built on top of it. But there was a river flowing northwards into the River Liffey. And that area in front of... the castle was a large pool, and because of so many leatherworks around the pool there, the pool water was black. So in fact, they named the town Blackpool. Okay? There's a town in England called Blackpool, but they named the town there Blackpool. And the Irish Gaelic word for black is dub, and the name for pool is lin. Dublin means Blackpool. So, Archbishop Usher was sent to the City of Dublin Free School, one of the very first free schools that came about in what was later to become the United Kingdom. Other alumni of the same school included John Churchill, who was later made Duke of Marlborough because of his military exploits in the Peninsular War, and of course his grandson was the famous, his great-grandson was the famous Prime Minister during the Second World War. Usher attended the school in 1589 at the age of eight. So this is a school that normally boys would go to at the age of 12. Usher went there at the age of eight. In other words, Usher had a very precocious childhood. Very precocious childhood indeed. In fact, he wrote in his journal that when he had heard a sermon on Romans 12, he said, "That led to me having very serious thoughts." How many 8-year-olds at that time would have written in their journal that they had very serious thoughts about Romans 12 at the age of 8? In fact, he read the Confessions of Augustine at the age of 10 and wrote in his journal that "I wept while I read them." This is a very precocious child. How many 10-year-olds here have read the Confessions of Augustine? In the original Latin, of course. "The principal part of my study at this time is spent perusing the writings of the fathers," by which he meant the apostolic fathers, the Christian leaders of the second century, "or observing out of them the doctrine of an ancient church." That's what he wrote, age 12. This was not a simpleton. Are you getting the picture of why I'm going through this biography? It's important. Now, He then went to Trinity College. Trinity College was given a royal charter to be the College of the Sacred and Undivided Trinity near Dublin, the first new university in the British Empire after Oxford and Cambridge. Usher entered Trinity College in 1593, so therefore he was one of the first students. He was aged 12 when he went to university. Age 12. At the age in 1595, at the age of 14, he began his massive work, The Annals of the World. That's when he began writing it, at the age of 14. Now, it did take him, to be fair, a little while to finish it, as we'll see. But he had drawn up his chronicle of the Bible as far as the Book of Kings and was awarded his BA at the age of 15. So he was graduating from university with a bachelor's degree at the age of 15. Okay, further on in his period of time then at Trinity College, in 1598, his father died. Well, James actually then resigned all of his inheritance at the time to give it to his brothers and sisters. He kept just a small portion for himself. And that's the beginning of his first major book, where he wrote a book called Answers to a Jesuit, where he had a famous disputation with the Jesuit preacher Henry Fitzsimmons. In 1600, he was awarded his master's. In 1600. And then in 1601, he was ordained. He became Professor of Divinity in 1607 at the age of 26. At Trinity College, and he became Vice Chancellor of Trinity College in 1615, a very young Vice Chancellor for a university to have. Well, he got married in 1613, and his first daughter was born in 1620, and on these dates, 1603, 1606, 1609, and 1612, he visited England, and these visits are very important. In each case, he wanted to go to Oxford, because he wanted to go to the famous Bodleian Library. He wanted to be able to study original documents, particularly as that had become a place where many of William Tyndale's documents had been brought, those that had been recovered, that hadn't been burnt in the time of Queen Mary. They were brought then to Oxford University, and that library had become a centre. Remember, Oxford University was famous for having, a couple of hundred years before, persecuted one of its own, John Wycliffe, but by this time it had become thoroughly Protestant and very much had many documents relating to the translation of the Bible. So his fifth visit, in 1619, he met King James I, who'd ascended the throne by that time. And in 1621, James I made him the Bishop of Meath. He went to study in England between 1623 and 1626. And in 1625, he was made the Archbishop of Armagh and Primate of All Ireland. And it was during that time when he was Archbishop of Armagh and therefore leader of the Anglican Church throughout all of Ireland that he did his famous calculation on the age of the earth. He was inspired very much by the Book of Kells having been discovered in 1621. The Book of Kells was actually not originally produced in Kells. It was actually produced in Iona, and it was an illustrated copy of the Gospels. That, in fact, is the Gospel of John there. We can read the words, Erat autem hora tertia, now it was the third hour, there on the right-hand side. So this was produced in the Isle of Iona, by the monks there, but when the Vikings destroyed that monastery, many of the monks escaped with this manuscript to Kells in Ireland, where they built a monastery, and they buried these objects. Now, these were discovered in 1621, and what it led to was a great revival in interest of having the Bible in people's ordinary language. And of course, 10 years before that discovery, 1611, 10 years before that, was the date of the publication of the King James Version of the Bible. But it was very much, people were talking about getting the Bible into other languages. It's interesting, by the way, that there was a suggestion at the time that maybe they should have translated the Bible into Irish. And here's an example of something, I think, where Archbishop Usher made a mistake. because he actually opposed the translation of the Bible into Irish. I wonder how Irish history would have been changed if the Irish people could have read the Bible in their own language. But it was a couple of centuries later before the Bible was ever translated into Irish. So the idea that they only have the Bible in English rather than their own local tongue really sort of underlined the idea, made people see Protestantism as a sort of colonial power rather than being an indigenous faith of the people. Okay, when Usher eventually went to England after the outbreak of the Irish Confederate Wars. The Irish Confederate Wars broke out at that time, at a period of time when there was a lot of violence going on in all the islands that today make up the British Isles. The Irish Confederate Wars were an attempt by Catholics to overthrow the Protestant ascendancy. And then they were almost immediately followed, once the army had put down the Confederate Wars in Ireland, they were almost immediately followed by the English Civil War. It was all part of the same unrest and warfare that was going on at the time. So this is what was happening. Usher, interestingly enough, declared for the king. That's interesting, because Archbishop Usher was actually very sympathetic to the Presbyterians at the time, but nevertheless decided to declare for the king instead of for the parliament. And in fact, Usher was in London. He moved to England in 1640, never returned to Ireland. His house was destroyed after that in 1641 during the Irish Confederate Wars, so he never returned to Ireland. 1642 was the outbreak of the Civil War. Usher was in Oxford, but in fact he moved back to London briefly. He was in London at the time of the execution of King Charles I, when England became a republic briefly under Oliver Cromwell. And it says on the slide there that he did go to places like Bristol and Cardiff and St. Donat's, but then eventually in 1646 he returned to London and witnessed the execution in 1649. Well, he was getting towards the end of his years at that time, and in 1654 he published the Annals of the World, unfortunately published them in Latin, not in English. He'd written the entire book in Latin. Now, Usher died in 1656, and it's a measure of the respect that he was held in that even though he had argued for the king, for the royalist side, for the losing side in the Civil War, the Lord Protector, Oliver Cromwell, who was ruling England at that time under the English Republic, actually gave gave Archbishop Usher a state funeral in 1656. 2 years later, the Annals of the World were translated into English, and translated into modern English more recently in 2006 in that particular book. Well, as I said, the book contains his famous calculation. Why is it that he said the earth was created at 6 p.m. the evening before October the 23rd, 4004? Well, it's because he made some assumptions about the Bible, assumptions that I believe are correct. First of all, he assumed that when you look at the genealogies of Genesis chapter 5 and of Genesis chapter 11, he assumed that there were no gaps in those genealogies. That when it says so-and-so was the father of so-and-so, was the father of so-and-so, that it means father, it doesn't mean grandfather. Now, you know, if there's not that many generations there, if we calculate all the generations from Adam to Abraham, we've got 10 there, and then, I've missed out a slide there. If I just go back, that one there, you've got, so we've got 10 there from Adam to Noah, and then from Noah to Abraham, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, another 10. So you've got 20 generations altogether. If you think the earth is 10,000 years old, you can only do that by adding an extra 4,000 to the numbers that Usher calculated. 4,000 divided by 20, 4,000 divided by 20 is 400 divided by 2 is 200. It means you've got to have 200 years gap in every generation. How many more people needed to be born in each generation? Can you see that stretches the genealogies too much? You can't actually have a sensible commentary on Genesis if you have those gaps. Well, here's what, you can't read all the writings there, but what he's done there is he's actually calculated the year that each of those people were born from the numbers in Genesis chapter 5 and in Genesis chapter 11. So if I pick a few of them, you can see that Noah was born there in 1,056 years after creation. He has dated that as being 2,948 BC, and we'll justify that in just a second. So that's what he's done. He's taken these years and he's added them up. And after Abraham, we read that Abraham left Haran at about the age of 75. We also find then that from the promise being given to Abraham to the Exodus is 430 years. That's what we read there in Genesis and also in Galatians chapter 3. From the Exodus to the beginning of the temple is about 480 years, so we've got that added on. It's actually 479 years. And from the start of the temple to the division of the kingdom, the time of Jeroboam's golden calves, that's 38 years. And from the golden calves to the final deportation of the Jews to Babylon is 390 years. So he's calculated all these dates. And you see, we think that Archbishop Usher certainly had evidence to suggest that the deportation of the Jews to Babylon happened in 584 BC. So from that number there, adding 584 to 3,420, that's how he got the date of 4,004 BC. Does that make sense? Yesterday evening, I did my own calculation, which I presented to the church there, and calculated the date of creation as being using these numbers that I extracted from the Bible. I got the date to be actually 4003 BC. So I from by 1 year, and there is a margin for error. That means I think the age of the earth is 6,020 years old, but there's a margin for error. And you need to understand that Archbishop Usher mentioned the margin of error as well. He's got it in his book. So many people think he was dogmatic when he said 4004 BC, October 23rd, 6 p.m. the day before. Nevertheless, he thought there was a margin of error too. Because when it tells you that Shem gave birth to Arphaxad at, let's say, the age, I can't remember what age it was, but if it was the age of 30, does that mean he was that was his 30th birthday, or does it mean it was the day before his 31st birthday? So do you see that there is a possibility of a year error at every single point on the calculation? So we could stretch the dating of the earth to about 6,200 years. I mentioned last night that you could actually stretch it another 200 years, because you may disagree with me over my dating of the Exodus, and that would add an extra 215 years to my calculation if you disagree with my dating of the Exodus. But you can't stretch the age of the earth beyond the date of 6,500 years. Here's what I produced on an Excel spreadsheet. And here's where we go back to the prophecies. And this is what Archbishop Usher pointed out. Remember I said that the name Methuselah is prophetic, because it means his death shall bring it about. Bring what about? Well, it brings the flood about. If there are no gaps in the genealogies, it means that Methuselah died the same year that the flood came. You see? If there are no gaps in the genealogies, Methuselah died the year the flood came. Do you think that's significant? If there are gaps in the genealogies, there is no significance to Methuselah's name whatsoever. It doesn't work. But if there are no gaps in the genealogies, then Methuselah's age is important. He died the same year that the flood came. He died, and then shortly afterwards the flood came, because Enoch prophesied that Methuselah means his death shall bring it about. Enoch, remember, was prophesying about judgment. As I said, we've got other words of his prophecy in the book of Jude. So it's all of a piece, and it fits. It makes sense when you realize that there are no gaps in that genealogies. So I just offer you that as evidence of there being no gaps in the genealogies. Look at this chart of the ages after the flood. Can you see how the ages after the flood decay? They decay in what amounts to pretty much an exponential decay curve. And that means that the ages on that list are significant. Very significant. For example, look at that age, 175. 175 is the age that Abraham was when he died. Okay? And it tells us in Genesis that Abraham was full of years. In other words, he died at the right age. Now, you see, when Abraham left Haran, he was 75 years old. Is that a good picture of the age of Abraham at the age of 75? See, I want you to understand that I don't think that is a very good picture of Abraham. I got that out of a children's story Bible. But I don't believe that that's what Abraham looked at the age of 75. I think he looked like that. Why? Because he became an old man at the age of 175 and died full of years then. So at the age of 75, he didn't get to the age of 75 and as an old man and then stay an old man for 100 years. That's not how it worked. He aged slowly. You see? So at the age of 75, he was the equivalent of a young man today in his mid-30s. And that means that Sarah, who was 65 at the time that they left Haran, was the equivalent of a young lady aged about 31 or 32. That means she was well within childbearing years. And that makes it all the more poignant when we read in Genesis 11 that Sarah was barren. Why does it say that Sarah was barren if she was already too old to have children? You see, it was medically significant, and people were believing that this was part of a curse. And this is so important. Archbishop Usher comments on these in his book. So there's what I think Sarah might have looked like then. I commissioned an artist friend of mine to do those pictures. I'm going to pass on that slide because I'm running out of time, so I want to just get through the calculation a little bit faster. Now, I've said that I think the 430 years of the sojourn are dated from the time that Abraham left Haran. Archbishop Usher agrees with that, or rather, I agree with him. Okay, let's get it right. He was the one who did the calculation, which means that he thinks that Abraham left Haran in 2083 Anno Mundi, 2083 years after the creation. That's 1921 years B.C., and that means the Ten Commandments would have been given shortly after the Exodus in 2513 AM or 1491 BC, 430 years later. That's where we may have a disagreement, because I'm dating the sojourn from the promise to Abraham. Some people, if you date the 430 years from the promise being given to Abraham, that means that the Israelites were only in captivity in Egypt for 215 years, half of that time, okay? Now, you may want to prefer to believe that they were in captivity for 430 years, in which case that you need to add 215 to my date for the earth and Usher's date for the earth. Do you see the point? There's another margin for error. But you're still not going to get the age of the earth anywhere beyond 6,500 years. You are not going to make it 10,000 years from the Bible. Even if you're going to disagree with me on the Exodus, you're still not going to get the age of the earth any farther. See, it brings up all sorts of problems. Who was the Pharaoh at the time of the Exodus? Well, many people have traditionally suggested that the Pharaoh would have to be Ramesses II. But there are two other possible candidates, Thutmose III in the 18th dynasty and Neferhotep I in the 13th dynasty. Well, in fact, it's likely to have been Neferhotep I. And the reason why we think that is because we think that the various dynasties in Egypt actually overlapped. They didn't go one dynasty then another. Those dynasties overlapped. So Neferhotep I, who was earlier, would have been the ideal pharaoh. And it's interesting to note that there is no record of his death. He just disappeared, which is a very interesting point if you believe that he was drowned at the bottom of the Red Sea. That would make sense, whereas we've got some evidence of where Ramesses II's tomb actually is. So that does not make sense as a candidate for who was Pharaoh. Neferhotep I's mummy has never been found. He just disappeared. And his son was never found either. He had a son called Warneferhotep, but he's disappeared as well. And it's interesting that an alien group came in after his disappearance, called the Hyksos. They came into Egypt and they took over Egypt, according to Josephus, without a battle. And so that would make sense if the whole of the Egyptian army had been drowned at the bottom of the Red Sea. There was no army to defend Egypt, even though before Egypt had been the superpower of the world. So it fits. So you see, when you have Usher's dates, or the dates that I've suggested, it makes a difference to what you think about the history of other countries around the world. such as the dating of those pyramids in Egypt. I've heard some people say, well, those pyramids must have been built before the flood. No, they couldn't have been built before the flood. They had to have been built after the flood, when the Egyptian people had migrated there from the Tower of Babel incident. The ancestors of the Egyptians had migrated there. Well, why October the 23rd? Well, that's quite easy to explain, because at the time, England had not made a change that the rest of Europe had made. You've probably heard that Britain is very different from the rest of Europe. You know? Sometimes people have said to me, what's it like living in Europe? And I tell them, well, I have no idea. I've never lived in Europe. And at the time of Usher, Britain had not adopted the Gregorian calendar. The rest of Europe had adopted what's called the Gregorian calendar. That basically means that every four years you have a leap year, okay? Remember that? But the year at the beginning of the century is only a leap year if you divide the total year by four. So the year 2000 was a leap year, but the year 1900 was not a leap year, okay? Because it doesn't divide by 400. Well, that's the Gregorian calendar. The Julian calendar didn't bother with that. It simply added an extra day on a leap year every 4 years. And that made the calendar get out of sync. And by the time we reached the time of Archbishop Usher, the English calendar was 32 days out of sync with the rest of Europe. In other words, October the 23rd was actually September the 21st. What's September the 21st? September 21st is the fall equinox. And in most civilizations in the world, the fall equinox has always been New Year's Day. New Year's Day has not been January the 1st in most areas of the world. The fall equinox has always been the beginning of the year. And it was certainly the beginning of the year at that time for Hebrew people, for the Israelites. So you see, Archbishop Usher was thinking it's much more likely that the creation would have happened at New Year's Day, as far as the Hebrew calendar was concerned, which would be September 21st in the Gregorian calendar, October 32nd in the Julian calendar. Why 6 p.m. the night before? Because, in fact, the Israelite people dated their days not from midnight, but from dusk to dusk. Dusk would have been approximately 6 p.m. And so that's why it was the day before 6 p.m. the day before. Do you see, Archbishop Usher is not being dogmatic here. You know, you think he's picked a date out of thin air. He hasn't. He's got a reason for saying it's October 23rd, because it's the fall equinox. And then he's got a reason for saying it's 6 p.m. because that's when they started counting the days. He knew his stuff. This is not a simpleton. And we're coming back to the point that Archbishop Usher was a very clever man. And that really sort of brings me to a conclusion here, which is this. I just wanted to mention there that the Hebrew calendar would have normally been, many ancient calendars would have been 12 months of 30 days each, with then an extra 5 days or 6 days every 4 years, basically the same as the Julian calendar. Britain didn't adopt the Gregorian calendar until September 2nd, 1572, during which time 11 days were dropped from the calendar. And that, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, is why there are 12 days of Christmas. Because previously they'd celebrated Christmas on one day, and now they were going to celebrate it 12 days before that, to account for that 11 days difference. And they basically then just spread in England, they just spread the celebration over 12 days, because they didn't want to miss out on a party. Instead of getting the party on the wrong day, they made sure they got it on the right day by having 12 days of celebrations. Okay? So there we go. From 4,000 years from creation to Julius Caesar, 32 days were dropped altogether. So October 23rd is the same as September 21st, which is what I've just said. So what have we learned? We've learned that Usher was a man of great intellect and scholarship, not a simpleton. We've learned that he was very learned in ancient documents. He knew what he was doing. He studied in both Trinity College Dublin and at the Bodleian Library in Oxford to make sure he got the original documents. He was learned in other disciplines as well. He was a polymath. A very, very intelligent man. The age of the earth, you can still get the same ballpark calculation. I've shown you that my calculation, and I don't pretend to be as clever as Archbishop Usher, but my calculation is just 1 year different from his. Other people who calculated the same date include people such as the scientist Isaac Newton. He calculated the age of the earth to be about the same. I think his date was 4005 BC. The Bible, you will notice, was foundational to Usher's entire intellectual output. This clever man, this polymath who was so learned, started by assuming that the Bible was true. And all his calculations and all his intellectual effort began from that point. Do you see that it is not intellectually inferior, it is not an intellectually weak position to start by believing the Bible is true? A man like Archbishop Usher, we now see, is not a simpleton, some sort of fundamentalist redneck who doesn't know what day of the week it is. No, he was a very, very clever man. And it was because he was a clever man that he put his faith in God and trusted that God's word was true. And all his expertise came from that point. And that's why the Usher's Annals of the World is such an important book. And although I've not got these books on my bookstall, you may have seen them elsewhere. It's possible the Apologetics Forum bookstall may have things like that time chart, which is called Sebastian Adams' time chart. I sell that in my center. There's the chronology of the Old Testament, also based on Usher's works. Unwrapping the Pharaohs, that gives better dates for the Pharaohs of Egypt, based on Usher's work. And there's a biography of Archbishop Usher that I've used as my main source material for this talk tonight. So as I said, I hope I've convinced you that this is an intellectually superior position to believe that God's word is true and that everything we learn and everything we work out stems from that initial presupposition. Thank you very much for listening. Now, just before I do take some questions, let me please just mention a couple of products you'll find on our bookstall. To show you that you don't need to have the intellect of Usher, I've written this book called Where Birds Eat Horses, which shows you how to look at scientific articles and just look at the language. You'll see that I've coloured in words with different coloured markers, and you do that simply by learning certain key phrases that evolutionists use, because I have discovered that the support for the theory of evolution is not scientific at all. It's their clever and deceptive use of language. So that book reveals that, and there is a homeschool curriculum to go with it. This book I originally wrote for adults, actually, but a lot of homeschooling families said, can you do a curriculum on it? So I did. So it's a homeschool curriculum for teenagers. I've also got this book, Only Believe, which is a book about apologetics, how we should defend the Christian faith by starting from the presupposition that God's word is true. It's what we call presuppositional apologetics. So I've got a book on that, and the well-known Canadian apologist Cy Ten Brugen, Kate kindly wrote the foreword to that book. You can get that book by itself, or I've got a pack of four books that I think are essential reading as an initial start to apologetics. This DVD set is my main DVD set as an introduction to the whole subject of Genesis and creation. It's six talks about the first two chapters of Genesis, going through the 6 days of Genesis. So there's six talks there with a study guide if you want to show it in small groups, so you can study that there. We've got that. And one more DVD that I'll point out is actually a DVD of tonight's talk, Archbishop Usher and the History of Biblical Chronology, filmed in Portland, Oregon, about 12 months ago when I gave the talk there. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Paul.